It's Andy Parks live from the Washington Times on 7:30 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT, The Truth. And I've got a couple of guys in studio. We're going to talk about a big story coming to the Washington Times in tomorrow's edition. It is called Last of Doolittle's Raiders. Now, right now you're thinking, all right, fill me in. What's a Doolittle Raider? I'll start with you, Ben Wolfgang.
Well, the Doolittle Raiders were 80 men in World War II, April of 1942, led by Lieutenant Colonel James Doolittle. They took off in B-25 bombers from the USS Hornet, stationed out in the Pacific Ocean, to bomb Tokyo and a couple of other Japanese cities as sort of a response to the attack on Pearl Harbor 4 months earlier. FDR, political leaders, military leaders were really itching to strike back at Japan for what they had done, how they had decimated the U.S. Navy and the U.S. presence in the Pacific at Pearl Harbor. So this was sort of what they came up with, and it had never been done before. B-25 bombers had never taken off from a Navy aircraft carrier before. In fact, there had never actually even been a joint mission between the U.S. Navy and the Army Air Force, which sort of collaborated for this mission. So these 80 men, and there are only five of them left today, all in their 90s, 16 planes, crews of five men, some of them were interned in Japan for a while. A lot of them died during the mission. So it's sort of one of the, I guess, untold stories of World War II. Certainly everybody knows about Pearl Harbor. Everybody knows about D-Day. Everybody knows about Midway. Not a lot of people know about Doolittle's Tokyo Raid. And it's something really that is equally important, I think.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, the other guest in studio is Drew Geraci.
That's correct.
Drew, you are a photographer, a videographer. You interviewed some of these people. Tell me about how you guys got together. How did you establish what you were going to do in this story?
Well, it was kind of a nice collaborative effort between, you know, the writing department and the multimedia department. We wanted to tell a story that, you know, hasn't been told before. And, you know, Ben over here is a fantastic writer, and he can really tell the story well. And I'm more of a visual person, okay, where I can, you know, visually come up with some great compositions of how these people are portrayed now.
Yeah. I bet you were honored talking to him.
It was incredible talking to him. I mean, it's you're talking with living history. You're talking with someone who was around in a time that not a lot of people can remember. I mean, these are guys in their late to early 90s.
Yeah.
And the stories that they tell, they're just incredible.
You would think, being of that age, you would forget a lot. But something like this, I guess, is ingrained in your memory forever.
Absolutely. Some of these guys, I mean, the vivid detail they have of remembering exactly what the weather was that morning when they took off, or exactly how it looked over Japan when they were flying in the B-25 bombers. The level of detail they have is really incredible. And I think something else that's worth noting, you and I talked a couple months ago at the anniversary of Pearl Harbor about the 1,000 veterans of World War II dying every single day and how quickly we're losing that generation. Doolittle's Tokyo Raiders, I think, is kind of a microcosm of that. You had 80 men on this mission. Only five of them are left. If we talk this time, in a, you know, next year or a couple years later, there might only be three or four left. So who knows? Mm-hmm. We're sort of losing the opportunity, I think, to capture these stories. And so that was one of the driving factors behind what Drew was able to do, is to go and find these five guys, sit down with them in their homes, and have them tell the story while we still are lucky enough to have them around to do it.
It's fascinating to me. I mean, what little I've read of what you've written, it's riveting. I'll tell you that right up front. And it actually made the hair stand up on my arms a little bit, because as a former pilot, I can relate to what some of these people were doing. This was a suicide mission, wasn't it, Drew? I mean,
that's exactly the way they had to look at it. It was a one-way mission. I mean, they didn't have enough gas to get back. They knew they were going to have to either make water landings or crash, basically. So for a lot of these guys, it was the understanding that they're probably not going to come back. And I think it's amazing that the majority of the crews that did go out actually came back and were unscathed.
B-25 coming off a carrier deck, that's a one-time shot. Either you make it or you don't, and you can't come back.
You can't.
You can't land it. It's not capable of landing on the carrier.
Right.
So this was, once you're off the deck, guess what? You know, we're at the mercy of God. We don't know what's going on, and we'll do the best we can. And I'm amazed, honestly, as many survived as did survive.
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, James Doolittle had, I think, less than 400 feet of runway to get his B-25 bomber.
Yeah, he was the first in line.
He was the first in line, which is also worth noting, because it's one thing to plan the mission and then tell your men to go out and do it. I mean, he was the leader of this, and he was the first guy off the deck in the first plane as the pilot. So when you hear these men talk about him, that still resonates in their minds, that this man obviously cared for them and was willing to put himself up front in harm's way to be the first one off the plane when nobody really knew what was going to happen after they dropped their bombs after Tokyo.
Now, the Japanese felt they were safe, right? They thought that that no one could get to them by air.
Right. They thought they were protected by a divine wind, I think is one of the things they call it. Sort of a godlike shield is what the emperor told them, what Japanese political leaders had been telling them. So this was sort of, it didn't do much in terms of military damage, but the psychological
effect,
the psychological effect of seeing bombs falling over Tokyo really kind of it changed the war, at least for the minds of the Japanese people. They thought, we're not as safe as we're being told. And it did have a military effect in the sense that it made the Japanese pull back a lot of their forces in the Pacific that were sort of far flung out there. They had to pull them back because the people were worried they were going to get bombed again. This would be a weekly or monthly event. Mm-hmm. So it did have some military effect in a strategic sense, but certainly the psychological blow was much more.
Yeah. When you talk to the pilots, Drew, or the guys that that survived, would you say five of them left?
There's five of them left, yeah.
Do you get the feeling that they take great pride in this, knowing that they really got to the psyche of the Japanese?
Well, I think for a lot of them, they didn't even really know what the mission was about to begin with. I mean, it was a mission in secrecy. They went to the secret location where they're learning how to take off of in 400 feet, mm-hmm. and they really have no idea what's going on. But at the same time, I don't think a lot of them knew exactly what kind of impact their mission had at the end, because you know the Japanese even said, or they kind of made fun of Doolittle, saying he had done little for the raid, basically, because they only carried three bombs with them. And they didn't really do a lot of damage at that point. So the pilots didn't really know the effect that it had on the war. But at the end of the war, they really realized what kind of effect it had.
Yeah. Were people impatient? Were Americans impatient with taking so long to retaliate against the Japanese?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's fascinating to go back and read some of the newspaper accounts and other retrospectives of what people were saying and what people were thinking back then, and to hear congressmen and senators talking about, we need to do something. We need to retaliate against Japan. So, even though it's only less than 4 months after Pearl Harbor, the burning desire for revenge in this country was really strong, both among your average guy in the street and certainly among political leaders.
Yeah. Right. Drew, I was just thinking about something. From your standpoint, being visual, mm-hmm. we don't have any of these planes. They're all gone.
Right.
The only thing we have are the people. And do we have photographs of any type? Do we have images from 70 years ago?
We've got a few images. I mean, there's a few images. It was a secret mission, so there wasn't a lot of publicity.
See, that's another thing that's a problem.
Yeah, it's just, the only images you have are the ones that either they took personally or just themselves. They're living history is what they are.
Yeah, no kidding. How many times during this, putting this all together, did you wish you could have talked to others?
Oh, all the time. I mean, you can imagine what it would have been like to interview, Jimmy Doolittle or interview all of the Raiders. Because an interesting thing is you sort of look at this from the big picture perspective of the Doolittle raid and what it meant for World War II and what it meant for the American public. But there are 80 stories within that main story. Each one of these guys has a completely different story of what happened after their plane crashed or landed, of what happened to them later in the war. One of their survivors went on to fight in Europe and was shot down by the Germans and spent 22 months in a German POW camp after taking part in the Doolittle raid. So certainly, with the 75 that have passed away, they all had stories like that to tell too. And certainly you wonder what it would have been like to be able to sit down with all of them and get those historical accounts face to face.
When you were done with this, you feel as though you did a good job with it?
I think so. And it's interesting because the guys are so willing to talk about this. They mentioned to Drew and I that they accept basically every invitation they get, whether it be from a civic organization or a high school assembly or anything like that. I think they sort of realize that they might not have that long to tell their story. So they'll get up there. They'll talk to media that shows up at their front door. They'll talk to high school kids doing a report. They'll talk to everybody about it, and they're proud to do so.
Yeah.
And that's really kind of heartwarming to see.
Drew, did you walk out of there and say, man, what a great story?
Absolutely. I mean, you're watching these guys, and they're getting emotional as they're telling their stories, and you're just like, you're reliving their lives. There's one with Ed Saylor where he had to leave a young Chinese teenager on the runway after this teenager had helped him over a course of almost a month, helping him get from China to the airport.
Yeah.
And it was just incredible to see, his eyes swell up and the emotion just, running out of, his words. It was just incredible, and he was reliving all of those moments.
Huh. I tell you, I look forward to it. It'll be in Friday's edition, tomorrow's edition of the Washington Times, Last of the Doolittle's Raiders, and it's by Ben Wolfgang and Drew Geraci. Thank you both for being here, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Andy.
Thanks, Andy.
358, 730 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT, The Truth. By the way, the page is up there, washingtontimes.com/Doolittle. washingtontimes.com/Doolittle. Check it out. You won't be sorry.